the Ninja Consultants will be appearing at the Anime Next Convention at the Meadowlands Expo Center in New Jersey, on Sunday, June 22, 2008. Aaron and Noah will present two panels, one at 10 a.m., the worst possible time slot, and one at 3 o'clock p.m., the second worst possible time slot. These times are subject to change without much notice. Look for signs outside the panel room for updates.
Dungeons and Dragons. Satan's game. Your children, like it or not, are attracted in their weaker years to the occult, and a game like D&D fuels their imagination and makes them feel special, while drawing them deeper and deeper into the bowels of El Diablo. This afternoon, the Dead Alewives Watchtower invites you to sit in on an actual gaming session. Observe the previously unobservable as a hidden camera takes you to the inner sanctum of Dungeons and Dragons.
Galstaff, you have entered the door to the north. You are now by yourself, standing in a dark room. The pungent stench of mildew emanates from the wet dungeon walls.
Where are the Cheetos?
They're right next to you.
I cast a spell.
Where's the Mountain Dew?
In the fridge, duh.
I want to cast a spell.
Can I have a Mountain Dew?
Yes, you can have a Mountain Dew. Just go get it.
I can cast any of these, right? On the list?
Yes, any of the first level ones.
All right, this could be it. Check it out.
For real?
Yeah, we are recording. I don't know, should this be a bonus episode or are we not numbering it?
This should probably be a bonus episode.
All right, this is a bonus episode of Ninja Consultant. And the reason this episode is happening this way is because, I think on the Anime World Order, they're always like, this isn't a regular episode of Anime World Order. So you should go back and listen to a regular episode and not pay attention to this bonus episode. There is no regular episode of Ninja Consultant.
Yeah.
So your odds are just as bad with any other episode as they are with this one. Sometimes a little worse.
But this one is mostly not about anime.
Right. Although we're going to kick off with some anime-related stuff just to keep...
So
we're not total horrible people. But what happened was, right before New York Comic Con, I received an email from the Wizards of the Coast PR department, and they were like, oh, hey, people are available for interviews if you want to talk to someone about 4th edition Dungeons & Dragons, which is launching soon.
Right, because it's launching soon, and that's where we should start.
And I was like, well, it launched this weekend,
yes.
At least the first part.
But it launched last Thursday.
They say in their interview that there are several rollout components. I responded to this PR email, because you could also do like a demo of the game, and I was like, oh, I bet Noah would really love to do this. And so I replied, and Noah was like, what were you thinking?
That's because Aaron doesn't know me at all.
He almost broke up with me. No.
No, false. That didn't happen.
Turns out, Noah's only interested in 2nd edition D&D and not really interested in 4th edition D&D at all. Anyway, by then it was too late. I'd already gone back and forth with PR people a couple times, and I felt like I would be a horrible person if I was like, forget it. Although I did get Noah out of the demonstration. I did not make him go to that. So we talked to a couple of nice ladies from Wizards of the Coast, and there's about a 20-minute interview that follows this part of the recording, where it's not totally useless. You eventually ask the question that you were going to ask them, which is there a way in the online component to pick up dice and roll them?
Right, because that's what's really important to me.
And the answer is yes.
Well, the answer is allegedly yes. We have yet to actually see that.
Right.
But whatever.
But it's not like Dungeons & Dragons has no anime tie-ins.
Right.
It so happens that a nice person named Matt Trevod wrote an article on his No Sword blog about Japanese language in March, around the time Gary Gygax died, to say he would look at the history of D&D in Japan. Wikipedia has an article about it that splits Japanese history, D&D history, into four ages: pre-translation, Shinwa, Media Works, and Hobby Japan. The pre-translation age, and I'm quoting directly from the article now, was one of the truly legendarily nerdy men and women without internet connections of any kind, importing at great expense books in a foreign language and studying the rules they contained for pretending to be an elf. Their cyclopean achievements made the otaku of today look like keg-chugging frat boys. The golden age lasted from the dawn of D&D in the mid-70s until 1985, when Shinwa ushered in the twilight of the ur-nerds by releasing the first Japanese edition of the game. The Age of Shinwa lasted almost a decade and is now remembered fondly for its bloopers, plutonium pieces for platinum pieces, reggae armor for leather armor, because the RNL problem. It's easy enough for a type error for a typesetter to make. There was also the period when Hagiwara Kazushi threw a beholder into his manga series Bastard, but had to give it limbs and rename it Suzuki Dogaimon for the trade. Anyway, it goes on like this. It's a really good article, and I will link to it. In a few anime series like Bastard, there's a direct Dungeons & Dragons influence, like in Record of Lotus Wars.
Which you only really need to watch maybe the first two episodes. The first episode is great. It's one of the best representations of a dungeon hack there has ever been in any media, I think.
Yeah, it's really good.
I can't recommend it highly enough. Unfortunately, something happened, and starting in the third episode or so, I guess Lotus Wars lost their funding or something, because the story goes downhill, the animation starts to really, really suck.
I appreciated the animation, but the dungeon, Record of Lotus Wars, and I think we've talked about it on this show before, is based on a novel. I think the novel is based on someone's actual Dungeons & Dragons campaign.
Yeah.
Anime World Order has talked about it extensively, too, saying that, I don't know, Deedlit was played by a dude in real life, and things like that. But there's a popular series of books in Japan. It's popular for people to print books based on their games, and they're called replay books. So it's as if you're kind of playing along by reading them. That would never happen here. I don't know. It sounds really... Most people's campaigns, when they start telling you about them, are incredibly dull.
Yeah, I don't think... I don't know what kind of market there is for that in Japan.
Well, Ed was telling us about it.
Here, there... It's true that there used to be more gaming publications, of course. That all went online. And you can find, for instance, our campaign has a quest notes diary sort of thing. So it is possible for someone to follow along.
Kind of. I don't follow along.
Kind of. You don't read that stuff.
Yeah.
It used to be the case that there were magazines and even some play-by-mail stuff where people would send in their scenario notes, their session notes, and people could keep up with the games as they were being played like that.
People who didn't play those games?
Right.
So like observers to someone else's campaign.
Right.
It's interesting enough. We haven't made it a secret that we play the game on our show, and someone wrote us a piece of mail asking us a Dungeons & Dragons related question. Do you have more to say about Bastard, or...
Well, I don't have...
Because I've never seen Bastard.
I've seen some Bastard.
Isn't it that the one where all of the people are named after heavy metal bands?
Yes, that's that one.
Okay.
And it is... With the Dark Schneider! It's, I don't know. It's enjoyable.
If you're a heavy metal fan, you'll really enjoy it.
Yeah.
I think also the moves are named after heavy metal.
That might be true. I don't know. It's not one of my
Jay
favorite
really liked
series.
It.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that Metal J, being Metal J, would love...
Dr. Metal J.
Dr. Metal J, our friend who dissects corpses and also listens to heavy metal.
He recently became a doctor.
He became a doctor.
He graduated from med school.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, congratulations. The other couple of bits of news before we get into the mail.
Yeah.
Today we went to the Mocha Festival, which is like an independent press and kind of small comics festival related to the Museum of Comic Cartoon Art in New York. It was awesome. I mean, there were a lot of great comics there, although it's also like 90 degrees here, which is not as awesome.
No, very hot.
One of our favorite artists who did a book that we picked up there last year called Book Hunter, which is amazing because it's like a 70s cop movie except for a librarian plotline.
It's like Read or Die, where instead of Yumiko Riederman and psychic paper powers, it's just a hard-boiled cop whose job it is to get back rare volumes that have been lost.
Yeah.
And there is a level of forensic detail to...
It's as if he's tracking
the book investigations.
Killer.
Yeah. It really is excellent. We'll post a link to how you can get that publication, but I recommend it highly.
His name is Jason Shiga, and he didn't get a table at the festival and ended up sitting outside in the 90 degree heat with only the books with him, which he was able to carry on the plane because he dislikes checking luggage. So if he's not dead, you should buy his book.
Or even if he is dead, his book is still good.
Fleep is also good.
Yeah. So here we are at New York Comic Con. We have Lene and
Lene
Katie.
Foster.
We are about to get a little demonstration or explanation of the new D&D 4th edition. I've, as listeners to the show know, I've played D&D for 20 years. So, what's it all about?
We're really excited about this release coming out. On June 6th, we're going to have the Dungeon Masters to Guide, the Player's Handbook, and the Monster Manual. We've updated about 8 classes right now. Mm-hmm. There are several key roles. Everyone has their rogue, their cleric, whatnot. What we've done is we've really streamlined a lot of it, so now everybody feels like they bring something really important to the table. There aren't many instances now where one player goes and they have their turnover just like that, and then another player takes 15 minutes, searching through a book and trying to choose from their whole list of spells. So then, it used to be that, you had your time, then you just kind of sit there. Well, now everyone, it's much more streamlined. And it goes kind of faster. It feels more cinematic because you just get to go a lot. It's an elegant game now. It really just flows really nicely.
I see.
Yeah.
And what?
Are you talking about the tabletop
game? Yeah, the tabletop game. Yeah.
And how are the mechanics changed to make it flow better?
Well, everyone, all the classes now have like a set of powers they can do. So there's like an at-will power that you can use anytime. There's an encounter power that is a little bit like stronger that you can use once in an encounter. And then there's the daily power, which is just the huge thing you can blow the monster away with, kind of a thing. And so you have this list that you can choose from, and you decide, I'm going to use this now, I'm going to use that now. No one's intimidated by having a really huge list. No one feels like they're left out because they don't have enough to do. And so you can just look at your character sheet and just go, that's what I'm going to do now. I know exactly where to go and that sort of thing. And, just every turn, you just have this great opportunity to just go, play, it's fun. Oh, it's my turn again. That monster is gone. It's awesome.
So when you're testing the game, is it like, I just kind of picture, like, does Wizards of the Coast have, like, some big laboratory where people are game testing all the time?
Yeah, we have white coats and goggles on. No, there are several groups, I think probably every day of every week, where people are getting together. My group has 8 players in it, but most of them are like 4 to 6 and a DM. We play for about 2 hours once a week, but I know other people who play 3-4 days a week. And we're trying to find at first just where it's broken. And now it's just finding, we're just having a good time now. I wanted the playtest to keep going on. I wanted to just say, I'm still testing. I have to keep playing. Come on, let's go. More and more. We play every Wednesday, and I find myself almost every day going, is it Wednesday yet? Is it Wednesday?
Yeah, well, I'm familiar with that.
Yeah, yeah. We get paid to play games. It's awesome. It's a great place to work.
That would be very dangerous if I were to get that job.
The conference room is set up in a special way, so able to
That's an excellent question, actually.
No, these are just, regular conference rooms. We have all sizes. We have one of the larger ones for our group because there's 8 players, but there's a whiteboard, and it's just, you just walk in, you feel like it's a meeting, and then you just automatically transport yourself into the game world, and you don't notice that there are, rolling chairs in there and that someone left a spreadsheet sitting on the table or anything like that. It's just suddenly you're transported to the game. It's awesome.
So, I guess about the online component, mm-hmm. right? Now I can understand why Wizards of the Coast might like to compete with World of Warcraft and some of the other MMORPGs. Mm-hmm. And it looks to me like that's what they are attempting to do with the online component that allows you to have players all over the world. Essentially.
Absolutely. There are a lot of groups that have broken up because somebody got married, moved away, got a job.
Yes.
You guys have been through it. Many people share that experience. And so we wanted people to be able to get the band back together. And so one of the ways is to do it with the internet, voice over IP that we have going on. You can basically hook up with your friends again.
And it's a subscription service?
Uh-huh, yeah.
What's the pricing?
We're still working it out right now. There are several elements that we're going to roll out because we don't want to put anything out until it's perfect, So we're going to kind of roll it out, and once it's fully established, everything's out there. We'll have the pricing system all set up. We have some preliminary thoughts, but we don't want to just come out and make a decision and then have to change it at another point. So. Right now what we're saying is the current plan is if you go for a month, just one, it's $14.99. If you sign up for 3 months, it's $12.99 for the 3 month, for each month. And then And then if you sign up for a full year, it's $9.99 per month. But some of that's still being vetted, and so it remains to be seen. Yeah.
Each member of the party would need a subscription?
That's right.
I guess I had heard it might be, like, is there a guest? There's sort of a guest.
There are some guest passes. There are some one-day things that you can sign up for as well. I don't know the pricing on those. I think if you're a member, you have an option for a couple free passes. Like there's a maximum per month or something like that to get your friends to come in and try it out.
And what are the online components?
Oh, they're exactly. Awesome. You guys are going to think this is awesome. So we have this character visualizer
right. Where
you can go in and pick your race. You want a female, half elf, something like that. You can go in and morph the size, the height, the weight, the face. There's different components. This is really something that it's awesome when you see and you play it with it. There's different, like you can change the hair, you can change the clothing. Everything we have like preset coloration. So, you know, you might want to have the eyes be blue or gray or whatnot. But they also have...
Don't worry about it.
There's also a full color wheel, so if you want to go in and have pink hair, you know, you can do that. You can add glow effects. We have preset suggestions as to what armor, you know,
sure,
this class
sure.
wear or whatever. But you can still take, you know, if your Dragonborn wants to wear leather armor or, you know, a mace from an Eladrin, they can do that. And, you know, so there's poses that you can move your character into. There's grips. There are 360-degree backgrounds, so you can turn your character around, look at it from all angles. They can save it and import it to your character sheet.
Mm.
So then we also have the character builder. You know, it's a nice segue, where you can go in and plug in your elements that you want. It calculates all sorts of things for you, so you still get to pick the feats that you want. We have the suggestions, but it's really just a fun way to build everything online if you want as well. And then everyone can take their character. I'm just going to keep talking.
Right? No, please.
So then the next step is you take your character and you can save it to the game table. The DM has this access to build maps and basically take these tiles and put together their own little dungeon. Or they can just use the preset ones that we build. And then you import your character to that. It becomes a virtual mini. And so then you can play the game going through the little dungeon, doing everything. The DM view is slightly different than the player view, so the DM can turn off and on different areas so the players don't see what's behind the door until the DM shows you and opens it up. The DM has the ability to hide certain monsters, so you don't know it until it's there. There's lighting effects, so if you want the room to be completely dark except for the four square area where the player has their torch, you can do that. There's a lot of fun that goes with this. You can drop in lava pits if you want to, or acid baths. I love the acid bath. So this is just cool. There will be some preset minis that you get. We're still working that out, but there's also microtransactions that go into purchasing additional ones if you want to. I don't. We're just having a great time playing with this.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Very exciting.
One of the big things though is the rules compendium, where when you're a subscriber, you have access to all the rules, everything. If you want to know what magic missile does, you type it in, pulls up everything that has to do with that. And that's updated regularly. So if you don't want to, you don't have to carry the books around with you. But one of the things that we're really trying to emphasize is D&D is still the pen and paper game that you want it to be. It can be completely analog. At the other end of the spectrum, you can play it all online with your friends. And you can go everywhere in between. You can make this as much analog as you want. You can make this as much online as you want.
So with having all the books electronically and stuff, so you can look them up, is that something that, like, if you buy the game, you can get just that part, and then if you didn't keep subscribing, you would still have those files? Or, do you know what I'm saying?
How do you mean?
Like, say you bought the game and in a box or whatever at GameStop, and, like, so you have the files like that are the rule books and stuff that are the electronic version of the rules?
Oh, no. So we're not prepackaging like a subscription card into the books or like a CD or anything like that.
Well, do you need to be a subscriber in order to have access to the online book, the rules?
It's less about ebooks and it's more that it's a database powered compendium. So it's fully searchable.
Right.
You can. And it doesn't have all of the content that are in the core rule books. It's lists, and it's a list of powers, list of feats, a description of magic missile and how you would, you know,
sure.
when you use it. But it doesn't have the backstory for the races. It doesn't have the details and the fluff for any of the classes. It doesn't have a lot of the flavor that makes the role-playing aspect of the game really, really rich. So when you are a subscriber to D&D Insider and you reference the D&D Compendium, you can find information that's helpful in playing your game, but it doesn't replace having the books. It won't tell you how to play the game. That's in the player's handbook, mm-hmm. but it will be a great resource if you need to reference feats and powers and, you know, oh, wait, what was that power I wanted to use this round? I read it, but I don't remember how it goes. You can look it up. And that's, like Lene said, part of that anywhere in between the 100% online, 100% tabletop, somewhere in between. You could, one person have a subscription in your group and you bring your laptop to your tabletop game and use the D&D Compendium to look up feats and powers.
But there's, at the moment, there's no consideration for like a pricing structure of like a la carte, where if you just want one aspect of the online structure, because what I had really wanted, because we now have someone who's moving to Singapore, right? And it was part of the group. The biggest stumbling block, because we can play over Skype, you know, and we've done this and it works okay, but there is no utility that allows you to roll dice where everyone can see it.
Right.
Where you actually have a little dice box or whatever.
You don't have to trust your friend in Singapore.
And you can pick up a virtual die.
We do have the die roller.
And you can roll it.
We have a die roller.
There's a die roller,
yeah.
But is it... Do you actually have a little polyhedron
that
rolls in the air?
Yes.
You do?
Uh-huh.
Okay. And that's...
Yeah, if the DM trusts you, you can do it on your tabletop as well. Just type it into the voice or to the chat box.
Well, right, but that's...
If you're trusting.
I mean, sure, I trust the guy, but you still...
But...
When you have to roll... a 20 in order to make things work out,
mm-hmm. yeah.
and you're all holding your breath, mm-hmm. it doesn't have the same effect if the guy's
right.
like, I rolled a 20.
Yeah. But so. Yeah, so we do have the virtual die roller, so you can go ahead and make sure that everything works out the way it's supposed to.
And that's networked. I mean, it's networked so that everyone sees the same window
uh-huh.
when those dice are rolling.
Yep, yep.
Well, that's very helpful, yes. that's really... That is what I wanted.
Oh, cool. Great.
An online D&D application.
When is all this launching? Or
it's going to be a rollout. So there will be some coming out right away when we launch the fourth edition in June. And then perhaps a couple months later, there'll be another one. And then a few more, you know, after that. So I'd say within, I don't know, the next 6 months to a year, we'll probably have everything out and ready to go.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good.
You guys sound like you're from Atlanta.
I'm not. Katie is from the Carolinas, and I've spent enough time with her this weekend that I've picked up on the accent.
Oh, no.
It happens.
I was picturing it as being this company in Atlanta, and then they go to Dragon Con every year or something.
I'm sure they go to... You've been to Dragon Con, I'm sure.
I have not.
No.
Never been to Dragon Con.
Like,
well, were you gamers before actually working for Wizards of the Coast?
I am now.
Well, you are now.
Yeah.
But you didn't... You had no real prior experience.
No,
no. And so these are like the first few conventions that you're going through now?
I've been with Wizards for 9 years now.
Oh, 9 years. So that's a while. Okay, so that's different. So.
Yeah. But, no, before coming to the company, I never did any game. Mm. You know, I played Solitaire on the tabletop at home. And, you know, maybe Monopoly on occasion. But now that I'm here, I'm won over. You know, I totally am. And the great thing, too, is, you know, third edition, I probably played that for a year and a half, mm-hmm. 2 years. And, you know, I had a great time with it, but I didn't always get everything about it. It was a little more complex than I could, you know, have the time to really work into. But now that we've been doing 4th edition, I've been playtesting it for probably the better part of 6 months. I picked it up immediately. I'm not saying it was simplified or dumbed down or anything, but it was just streamlined in just the right ways that a newbie...
Uh-huh.
And I still consider myself a newbie. A newbie can come in and pick it up and get it. There's still a lot of tactics to go into this, so you still have that sense that you're really using your brain when you play the game.
Mm-hmm.
but it's a little more intuitive.
Yeah, that's good, because it is hard to get new people into the game where you're like, oh, my friend is interested in playing, but if you have...
And some people might think it's really intimidating, you know, there's a lot to learn about it. It's a lot easier to get into now, I think.
Well, what happens every time you pick up the dice?
I forget how to play.
I don't think you're going to have it anymore.
Even if I play for most weeks, I still often forget the rules.
Exactly. Yeah.
I know that a lot of the math things I have problems with are fixed in 3rd edition. From when we play with someone who's played 3rd edition, they're like, oh, usually with that number you go up in the 3rd edition. I'm like, yeah, that would make sense, wouldn't it? I'm glad they fixed that for 3rd edition that we're not playing right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much in 4th edition, what you want is to roll high.
Well, I'm a stickler for 2nd edition, but part of that is 20 years I've been playing, right?
Right.
So, firstly, it's what I know, but also there is an element of limitation which was taken away.
Yeah.
And where a lot of people like that, because, for instance, 2nd edition, a halfling can't be a paladin. You can't have a halfling paladin.
You can now.
Can't do it. Can't do it. That's just the way it is. You can't do it. There are limitations in place that I felt kind of informed the kind of game that you could have in a more sort of resonant way, a more meaningful way. Because I play role-playing games for the world creation aspect of them. I mean, the campaign that we've been playing now, how long has it been going on total? Like 9 years, I guess?
Yeah.
We weren't playing it to begin with. We've been playing 6 years. But we've got a wiki that it's huge.
Right.
We have now sort of a growing encyclopedic database of this world. And so very specifically what I look for in a game is the ability for the game mechanics to simulate some kind of reality.
Mm-hmm.
I was turned off from 3rd edition, yeah, because it seemed very much designed to take people who had been playing Final Fantasy and give them some tabletop rules that were digestible. There's nothing wrong with that. It hurts me a great deal to see how in the days of my misspent youth, we were all rolling dice at the table, and now everyone is around their Nintendo. Now they're playing World of Warcraft. Now, yeah. And this to me is a bad thing. I was not happy when things went in that direction. So,
I guess... D&D is still analog. You know, you can still play tabletop. And so we know that that's important to our audience. And that's
and
why,
we do.
Specifically
about 4th edition, what I'm interested in is the utilities that will allow us to take the game that we've been playing, the 2nd edition game, and make it so that our friend in Singapore can play online.
Yeah.
So.
And one of the neat things about the online game is the grid. It's not adjudicated, so nothing's going to tell you, okay, this is what you do now. The DM still is key. The DM still says, okay, yes, you can do that. If you want to climb the statue, sure. Or no, it depends on what the DM says, you know. So it's not like a mindless game in any sense. It's really just limited by your imagination, which is always how D&D has been.
Well, I think, do you have any more questions? Oh, all right. Well, thank you very much, both of you.
All right. Thanks a lot.
All right. So our listener mail. And I would like to emphasize, you can write to us all you want. The emails have trickled off, and I don't know if it's because I don't post shows as often. I've been posting shows pretty regularly for the past month or two, or it's because we stopped reading mail on the air, or if the whole nature of podcasting has changed. Like, the podcast I listen to, they used to respond to reader mail a lot more, and now they respond a lot less, so maybe people write less reader mail, because they were only after fame to begin with.
Right.
If you have something that you want us to read on the air,
or maybe it's because I said, "Hey, don't read us mail because we think that you're a jerk."
Why would anyone do that?
Huh? Well, no.
Could it be that we read their mail and I call them jerks, or I'm a jerk?
Oh, that might be true.
Anyway, our email address is ninjaconsultant@gmail.com.
Right.
If you have any questions.
And here's some mail. And this comes from 6 weeks ago, I guess. And I'm really sorry that I didn't get around to answering this sooner.
What is the date on there?
The date is April 16. It is now June 9th.
Yeah.
So sorry about that.
June 8th.
Do I give his first name and last initial?
Do that.
Okay, so Edgar M. Lame. Writes, I have some questions about D&D. I know you're not D&D consultants, but I thought I'd give it a shot since Noah's into D&D. Anyway, I'm trying to start a D&D game with my buddies, but I'm having trouble getting started. I have the Player's Handbook, the Dungeon Master's Guide, and the Monster Manual, but these are basically reference material. Are there any online resources or books I could buy to learn how to be a good DM? We played a few of the adventures that came with the starter D&D product. We had a lot of fun, but me and my buddies want a little more. Any suggestions? Well, I'm going to answer your question, but you're going to regret having asked it.
Oh my god.
Because...
Again, try and keep this answer under 15 minutes.
It's an incredibly deep subject, and the short answer is there is probably no one and nothing who can teach you to be a good dungeon master. You need to essentially practice, which is play, a lot, and you'll find out what works and what doesn't work. But there's this guy, Ron Edwards.
Oh, that's not where I thought you were going this.
Well, that's where I'm going with this.
Well, who the heck is Ron Edwards?
Well, I'm about to tell them.
Good.
There's this guy, Ron Edwards. And about, oh, good God, now almost 10 years ago, I guess, there was a real lull in the gaming industry because the role-playing game tabletop market is inherently a poor business model. Actually, I think in relation to the D&D 4th edition release, Tycho on Penny Arcade mentioned this, and the business model for Dungeons & Dragons and all of those tabletop role-playing games is based on getting people to buy new modules or products or game aids or what have you, because after you buy the first, as the email says, there are really three core books. The Player's Handbook, which has rules for the player. The Dungeon Master's Guide, which gives you, as a Dungeon Master, kind of the context for playing the game. And then a bunch of monsters in the Monstrous Compendium that you can throw at the players. And once you have those...
I thought it was the Monster Manual.
That's the Monster Manual or the Monstrous Compendium or the Fiend Folio or what, depending on which release of D&D you're talking about. I guess it's called the Monster Manual now. After you have these books, you have all of the game mechanics, and that means that you can literally never buy another book because the rest of it will come from your imagination as the Dungeon Master and the cleverness of your players as you create scenarios for them and run them through.
But really, you should be buying...
Run them through. I mean, run them through the game.
Oh, sorry, I ruined your joke.
Yeah, that's all right.
But really, you should be buying a lot of books.
Well, no.
Like, of not D&D books,
If you want to keep the game companies in business, which the model has failed and lots of publishers have gone out of business, and even TSR was bought by Wizards of the Coast. Wizards of the Coast is now releasing 4th edition for a very specific reason, I think, which is to try and combat World of Warcraft and other massive multiplayer online role-playing games that have sort of pushed the tabletop market out. Nobody plays D&D anymore, at least not like in the numbers that they used to, because now everyone just plays World of Warcraft. And so with 4th edition, they've introduced a very heavy online component so that you can play tabletop over the internet. Now this on the face of it is excellent. It's a subscription service and I have no intention of...
And there are people who already play over the internet, like even we've tried it where like you just have someone on the other end of Skype, and I guess maybe if you had a webcam or like an iChat program where you can kind of see them with a webcam.
And there is essentially nothing that they could provide in their online utilities, which I should say that I have not seen or used at all.
Because you avoided the demonstration.
No, because in the demonstration I had already seen.
Yeah.
The online components were not being demonstrated there.
Okay.
It was just character creation and dungeon creation and all that stuff. And you can see those on YouTube, and I guess I'll we can link to them as well. There's nothing that they can provide that isn't already available somewhere for free. It's just not as glossy.
Right.
Be that as it may.
I was going to say you should read books about the quest of legendary heroes in historical text. And
okay,
like
so
that.
We won't start with Ron Edwards. Instead, we'll start with our campaign.
Because that's what our DM reads.
Our DM is he's crazy, and he's easily the most well-read person I've ever encountered, and this goes badly for the players because he knows a lot more than we do, and as a result, he knows exactly what's going on all the time, and we never have any idea.
That's the point of the game, isn't it?
Sure.
Why, if the DM doesn't know what's going on, your DM is asleep.
Then it's probably not a very good game. But our DM has set the game in a historical time period. It is now August 6th, 988, in the Byzantine Empire.
What an airplane.
I guess we're now in Italy somewhere. We're using real geographic places, real people who existed at the time, are alive at the time. Of course, there are plenty of elements of magic and monsters and so forth, which, when you go to the source material from that era, you read the Norse sagas or, you know, historical records of travels and stuff, like the Prester John thing.
What is that?
I forget. It's a travelogue.
Well, we'll put it in the notes.
We'll put it in the notes. But basically, because there was such little, it was so difficult to travel and so few people did it, those people who did travel frequently claimed they traveled a lot more than they did. And so you got these outlandish stories about how when you leave civilization, you find races of people with mouths in their stomachs. And then you go over to the next kingdom and it's filled with giant ants who collect gold. And then you go into the next kingdom and it's all people who have one foot and they hop up and down. And,
it's like Kino's Journey, but less abstract.
Less post-apocalyptic, I guess.
Less of a commentary on society and more about ants catching, like, hoarding gold.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So there are people who say D&D is just killing people and taking their stuff. And for some people, that's the kind of game they want. And so this is a very roundabout way of getting back to Ron Edwards, who came out of this sort of movement among independent game publishers around 2000-2001, where nothing was going on in the gaming world. And they decided to sit down and try and figure out what makes people play these games, what the difference between a good game and a bad game is, and why, and this is something that he stresses a lot, why were there so many people playing role-playing games and not enjoying them? This might resonate deeply with anyone out there who has had the experience of the sort of mixed feeling of really looking forward to the next session and really dreading having to go and dealing with the other players, but you keep doing it. And this was universal phenomenon. Well, many people kept doing it, even though it had lost a lot of its fun.
Yeah.
Because they started playing when they were in middle school, and the charge that they got out of playing it was so great that they kept playing it, but somehow it stopped being fun somewhere along the way. And so he sat down and talked to a lot of people and tried to figure out what it was that made people want to play the game. Then, a little bit later, they started this discussion forum online called The Forge. Post a link to it. It's a heavily academic discussion, and it's also a discussion between game designers, not game players. So some of it is...
Are you recommending that this kid read The Forge?
Yeah, but I'll get to that part.
Okay.
So he came up with the GNS theorem.
Because I wouldn't really recommend that. If they're like beginning gamers, none of The Forge will make any sense. Like, it won't make sense until you've played a lot of games.
All right, well, fair enough. So
you should probably like play in some other people's games too. I mean, I guess if you don't know anyone.
Well,
or go to your local comic book store and see if anyone's looking for players, or look on
meetup.com. Right, well, I said he was going to regret asking the question.
Or go to a gaming convention.
And since Aaron is twisting my arm, I will, yes, what you need to do is play play different systems. Don't just play D&D.
And
play...
read up on myths and legends about epic heroes, like, or some Joseph Campbell stuff or something.
That's good, except the problem with Joseph Campbell stuff is that he has a very specific structure. And it's certainly it's good to read it, but because it's a more organic means of play, where there's not one author, but maybe six or seven, because the Dungeon Master is providing the setting, and the players are providing the characters, and nobody can predict
what I'm saying to read Joseph Campbell for. What I'm saying to read it for is the actual mythological stories that he's talking about. Because if you read, like, the story about, what's his name, Cú Chulainn or something?
The Irish hero.
Yeah, like, that might be one of the sources that's cited, or a story that's interpreted in Joseph Campbell's methods. But I'm saying the folktales and legends and things themselves, you get the occasional, like, epic hero or someone going on a quest. It's the stories that he's analyzing are ones that you want to read.
Yes, that's certainly true.
And it's a cheap way to get a bunch of short ones in one single book instead of going out and buying those. Like, instead of buying an Irish Legends book individually or another Legends book individually, you could pick up a single, like, you could pick up the hero's journey and flip through it and find, like, oh, well, here's a story about this and a story about that. And then if you want to find out more about it, then you look on Wikipedia or something like that. I'm just saying. Well, because Hal reads about, like, the heroes going on journeys and questing.
Well, Hal reads every piece of source material that he can lay his hands on, but Hal reads everything. And
you also want to read The Hobbit about 400 times, because that's what D&D is based on?
Well, that's tough. D&D, as Gary Gygax sort of imagined it, is based on all of this source material.
Yeah.
He's incorporated a lot of modern fantasy, a lot of Tolkien, of course, and you find, especially in the first edition game book, where he's taken a lot of Norse mythology and the German Ring of the Nibelung stuff, and he's incorporated all of it into a kind of mechanics.
Yeah,
and
you can read the Ring Saga adapted into several different comic book forms.
That's true.
And that's a good place to start. Or listen to the Radiolab episode about the Ring Saga,
which I guess we'll post a link to that. You didn't really listen to that.
I listened to the whole show.
I didn't listen to the whole Ring Saga.
I didn't listen to the opera.
No, I know that.
I listened to a podcast about an opera.
Well, it would also take you like 3 days to listen to the entire Ring cycle. Look, I have a point, and I'm going to make it.
Make your point about the Forge.
My point about the Forge is there are essentially three systems of play for gamers. The first system is the gamist system, the second system is the narrativist system, and the third system is the simulationist system, and you will find your players fall into one of these three categories as kind of championed by Ron Edwards, this guy who made the Forge. Gamist players are the ones who try and take their stats and make the most powerful characters, not necessarily because they are jerks, but because they look at these games as games to win, to use the mechanics in your favor as much as possible. If having higher stats means that you get material advantage in adjudicating gameplay, then that's what they're going to go after. They always want the highest stats in the most sort of effective places. And they think in terms not of moral questions necessarily or plot questions. They think of tactics. And they think of how to use the rules to achieve their objective. And these players, they get a lot of a really bad rap. And one of the things that Edwards did was to really lay it down that this is an okay method of gameplay if everyone is having fun. And that's how you know if you have a good game, because everyone's having fun. Now, I don't necessarily believe in fun.
Yeah,
I think it's a duty. Playing D&D is a duty.
I was going to say, before you read The Forge, you might want to just play through a few pre-made modules
they've already done some modules.
That you played, and like, what did you like and what did you dislike, and then play towards a campaign that will play up those strengths. Like, if your players really enjoyed arguing about the rules, then, I don't know, maybe they can already determine, like...
you can make the obstacles game mechanics related.
Right.
That's the more sword and sorcery combat aspect of the game.
Right. If your players just enjoyed role-playing and not really the rules.
Well, we're getting to that.
All right.
So the second schema is the narrativist schema. And that's for people who are...
Schema. What's a schema? I'll just look on this dictionary.
Fine. While Aaron is looking up schema, system, I guess, paradigm, if you want.
Logic. A syllogic... A syllogistic figure, a conception of what is common to all members of a class, a general or essential type or form.
Yeah.
A representation of a plan or theory in the form of an outline or a model.
That one.
A representation of a plan or theory in the form of an outline or a model.
Great. Model.
If there are 14-year-olds who listen to this...
Well, then they should be looking up things at home, too. But most 14-year-olds, they'll know a word like schema.
Maybe the ones listening to our show, I hope. What about people abroad? For whom English is a second language.
I'm sorry. I don't know what to say
that. Anyway.
Please. So you have players who are interested primarily in the plot and forwarding the plot. These are people, and I mean, I say players, but also DMs favor one or the other method as well. You have, for instance, if your players roll very badly in an encounter, but killing them off or... even seriously hindering them would really put a big sort of a big block in the plot. If things don't go the way you feel they should, then players and DMs tend to sort of ignore what the dice say. Like if you're all killed by a bunch of chipmunks, that's kind of lame.
That kind of almost happened.
Yeah, we were almost killed by a bunch of evil squirrels once. That did happen. But there are things that happen because the dice say they happen that everyone is kind of bummed out by. Like, if an encounter is too easy or too hard, or if something happens that would completely change the whole scope of the narrative, people who enjoy playing the narrative's game will fudge. So you can stay on track with the story, rather than suddenly if, you know, the princess you're supposed to save gets killed.
Whoops.
That can be a bit of a downer. If the guy who is supposed to provide you with all of this information that you really needed, if you kill him instead of getting that information...
It happens more often than you'd think.
The DM might then decide, rather than having you essentially kind of start a different game, because, well, there was this one guy who knew this one thing that you needed, and now he's dead. Or, God help us, if there's one book at the bottom of a dungeon... that you needed to save the world, and that book burns up.
And then the dungeon got flooded.
And then the dungeon gets flooded. Like, you're in a bad way, right? And a narrativist DM will say, well, maybe there's another way for you to save the world, or what
have you.
There's
a copy of the book in another dungeon.
Yeah, there are things that will bring you back to the main storyline. So,
and that's narrativist.
And that's narrativist, and that is also a perfectly... fine way to play, assuming everyone is having a good time. Now there's the simulationist position, which tends to seem the most ridiculous to people, but I am a simulationist myself, and so I kind of have to stick up for it. Simulationists simply like to play the game immersively. Immersively meaning, at least as far as the game we play, here you are, you're in 10th century. 10th century Byzantium. You're in Constantinople. You can't go in life. You can't go to Constantinople. Now it's Istanbul. It's full
not
of
same.
It's full of Turks.
It's being gentrified.
It's not Greek. You can go to Hagia Sophia, but Hagia Sophia is it's a mosque now. Or forget about Constantinople. The Hanging Gardens of Babylon, gone. You can't see them. Gone for 2,000 plus years. Library of Alexandria burned up.
It's like the way that I play, like, I only really care about visiting those places if it furthers the plot.
Yeah, so...
Because I'm a narrativist.
Aaron is narrativist.
But for Noah, he's like, oh my god, we're totally visiting this place in the game, and he's really excited about it.
And so, what I play for is the feeling of existing and having agency in a time period that I cannot otherwise experience. That means that, as in our game... there certainly is a plot, but whether or not you follow it is entirely up to the players. And this is crucial,
yep.
The plot progresses whether or not we follow along with it. So if you spend 3 or 4 months wasting time twiddling your thumbs, playing circus games or whatever, out in some podunk city in Anatolia.
Wait, did that happen?
Well, I don't know.
In the game?
Yeah, pretty much.
Who was doing that?
If you spend all your time in Chrysopolis, things in the rest of the world continue to happen. So there's stuff going on, unbeknownst to us as players, that will affect us at a later time that we are not interacting with. We could be. We could have decided that, oh, we're going to go talk to this person. We're going to go try and solve this riddle or go on this quest or try and, defeat this warlord or what have you. But we didn't, and so there are consequences to not doing those things.
Right. Wasn't there a fourth type of gamer, or what is it, simulationist, narrativist?
Oh, yeah, that's sort of a...
Because you got about 4 minutes to wrap this up.
All right, fine. So there is the fourth kind of player, and this kind of player doesn't really fit into the theory. This is the kind of player who shows up just because they want to hang out with their friends.
Oh, wait, maybe that's the type I...
Right.
I started off being that.
And these people are very cool because they almost never miss a session, but they're not that into it. They're perfectly happy to do whatever everyone else wants to do. They'll often be reading a book or whatever while this is going on. And for them, it's a totally social experience.
Hmm.
And they can potentially fit in with any of those three types,
yeah.
Although typically they have a hard time with the gamist type, where a lot of it is number crunching.
Boring.
And yeah, it's not so much game playing as game lawyering. But
right.
Then I am not a gamist, and I am kind of biased against the gamist standpoint, although it's taken a long time, but now I can say there's nothing necessarily wrong with being a gamist.
Oh, we had to really come to terms with that.
Well, this is why when I said, Ron Edwards was asking the question, why aren't people having a good time? It's that you have people in any given gaming group, you have people with different styles of play, and there's only one DM. And so they are pulling at him or her in three different directions. Someone wants to be simulationist, and that's going to piss off the narrativist because they want to get on with it already. And
someone wants to talk with the DM about how his life is going.
Right. Talk to characters.
What books you've been reading lately? I mean,
although
out of the game.
I thought I was bad. Now we have there's another player and his character who is a bard. That's all he ever wants to. Let's just sit down and talk about this for a minute.
What?
Like, I'm sure if we all, that's Arbin, Chris's character. Look, all we have to do is just sit down and it'll be great. We just need to talk this over. And in fact, he tried and succeeded, unfortunately, perhaps. He tried to just sit down and discuss something with a very evil lich. And there are some people that perhaps you shouldn't talk to. That's actually a hot political topic these days.
For the non...
not to digress.
What is a lich for the non-gaming listeners who have made it this far?
And bless you, sirs.
The people who just want something on in the back. Perhaps my mother.
Your mother.
Who just wants to hear our voices.
What is a lich? A lich is a powerful undead wizard. So, right, you have, in any given gaming group, you have people who are all trying to get different things out of the game. Each one of them believes very strongly that their method of play is correct. This was as nasty as any flame war has ever been. It's just a game. We should concentrate on rolling dice and winning encounters. But no, it's a story. We should concentrate on finding out the answers to these questions. And then rarely you have the guy who's like, no, I just want to, I just want to explore.
Movie,
I just want to, no, that's the other
the
one.
The social one, yeah.
I'm talking about the simulationist player
right.
Who's like, I don't really care about plot. I just want to explore the world. I just want to see what there is. If your DM does a lot of research like ours, it's kind of like getting, gosh, it doesn't sound very exciting when I say it like this, but it's kind of like getting a lecture about some topic of classical or medieval history by interacting with people, with peasants from the 10th century or what have you.
Mm.
And that sort of thing, I think, is super awesome.
Like the time that we went to that town and everyone was really rude to us.
Oh, yeah. That was Antioch.
We looked it up later, and people in that town were known for being rude.
They're known for their biting sarcasm, because Antioch experiences an earthquake, like once every two generations, that does horrible damage. And so everyone is accustomed to being really sardonic and like, oh, life sucks. Because they know whatever they do, there's just going to be another earthquake and it's going to make their lives hard.
But yeah, we were like, why are all of our random people we're talking to, why are they all being jerks?
Yeah, historically accurate. I don't know, most people would probably not care that we were hacking one dungeon and it was the tomb of Saint... God, what was the St. Maximus. It's right across the Bosporus from Constantinople. And we were attacked by these glowing lights. And so much, much later, I was doing research for the game, and I ran across a hagiography. It's like a life of the saint for St. Maximus. And it mentioned how his crypt is protected by glowing lights.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, that's really cool. So that's part of it.
Oh, yeah. Do you think reading the lives of saints would help out in your game, but only if it took place in, like... Because do some of them have crazy magical elements?
Oh,
like,
tons have crazy magical elements. And something like the lives of the saints would be good to read because they didn't start out... These people didn't start out as legends. And then over the course of their lives, they do things and they take on symbolic aspects that makes them larger than life, and then the tales of their journeys are turned into legends, and you find cross-culturally, and of course this is what Joseph Campbell talks all about, you find that there are elements from every different region that are similar. Like all of those folkloric aspects, the details are different, and the emphasis is perhaps different, but the stories at their heart are representative of aspects of the human experience and the human condition. They are a means of teaching. They are a means of communicating wisdom in cryptographically, where it's easier to teach them in the form of myth than it is to simply lecture on them.
Oh, I think that like on Dave and Joel's show, or maybe it was the Grubberzilla podcast, or they were guests on the Grubberzilla podcast, they say that like as soon as someone mentions Joseph Campbell in an argument, like they're nutcase, and you should disregard the discussion.
Everyone is so sick of Joseph Campbell that they just want to punch him in the face, which I understand.
Yeah, but a lot of these books we mentioned, you don't have to go and like buy a book on the life of saints. You're probably not going to read, and it's probably going to be huge. You should probably just go to your local library on a weekend and like do some research, take some notes, and you don't have to buy anything. You can go
or forget the library, the lives of saints, and most sources. It's all online. The vast majority of the research I've done for the game has been online. Hal, of course, is an incredibly fast reader, and he goes to the library, I think, twice a week and has been reading books and books and books for decades.
Do you think Norse mythology is a good thing to read?
Sure. Norse mythology, it's all good.
Mm.
And especially myths. I mean, Greek mythology is great, but it's even better to look at mythology that is not well represented in the Western tradition. Indian mythology, not American Indian, although that's interesting too, but Hindu Indian from India. Hindu mythology is very interesting. Balkan mythology, it turns out Albania has all of this crazy mythos that's just super awesome. All of the different weird cultural things that they do, just bizarre. And their monsters are disgusting. Yeah. Albanian monsters, the most disgusting ever. I know, okay, Erin wants to...
Yeah, we've got
to
wrap this up.
She's making cutting motions
like
this.
That's not true. But I do have a timer running. But yeah, I'm trying to keep the podcast in such that when I'm done editing them, I put them online.
Right, okay. So I'm just going to tell you about this monster called the Kolshedra. This is your prize for making it to the end of the D&D podcast.
No, because we're the interview after this.
Oh, good God. So
well,
this is your prize for halfway.
And then the break.
So
something.
The Kolshedra started out as a snake. And snakes are all over Albania. And if a snake is left in a dark room for 7 years, it turns into a monster called a bola. And it's a bigger snake. And it's mean. And then if it's left for another 7 years, it turns into an even bigger snake called a bolar. And that one is even tougher and meaner. And so it keeps evolving like a Pokemon, if you will.
Right.
Until I don't know how many generations or iterations, I guess, of being in a darkened room for 7 years.
Uh-huh.
But eventually it turns into this hydra-like creature called the Colchedra that has it's hairy and it smells and it's covered in breasts, and the breasts leak poisoned milk that they like squirt at you.
Which is weird because I don't think reptiles feed their young.
Oh, but it's a monster, so it doesn't matter. And in addition to the breasts, which are horrible enough, it urinates, and wherever it urinates, these horrible maggot creatures
Ew.
Appear from the ground
Ew.
And start crawling all over you. That's nasty. So when you think about all the problems in the Balkans, think about the Colchedra and how disgusting it is.
What? Is that in the monster manual?
The Colchedra?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. I don't think there was ever an Albanian supplement. Although, who knows? Maybe there was. They put
the
out a lot of supplements.
What's the point of this monster story? Because it's a real monster story?
Because it's a real monster coming from Albanian mythology. And I can, with almost absolute certainty, say whoever is listening to this podcast has never heard of a Colchedra. And
write to ninjaconsultant@gmail.com if you've heard of a Colchedra.
Then I will owe you a Coke.
Like 50 nerds are like, send me my Coke.
I did my PhD dissertation on Albanian monsters.
You might listen to our show.
If so, write to me. I want to talk
Send
to
me
you.
Your dissertation, Ninja Consultant.
In our game next, we are going to Albania, and I am scared of the Colchedra, let me tell you. I hope that was helpful. Probably not, but you got more than you could have possibly wanted.
Oh, that's creative.
I'm not worried about my creativity, Mark. I'm the Dungeon Master. I control worlds, universes. Every potion you drink, I mixed. Every magic item you find, I put it there. Do you remember when you killed that hill giant?
I rolled a 20, double damage.
You rolled a 19, Mark. I fudged it. That giant would have killed you, man. But I admired your spark.